Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the growing concern that Donald Trump's calls to his supporters to go to the polls, quote, in certain neighborhoods to make sure the election is not stolen, an election he has already claimed will be rigged, will result in voter intimidation across the country from untrained poll watchers who will show up to challenge voters and in some cases might be armed. Joining us is Kristen Clark, the president and executive director of the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, which leads the National Nonpartisan Election Protection Coalition, made up of more than 100 local, state, and national partners working to defend the right to vote. We'll discuss the widespread concern that this election, the first without Section 5 protection of the Voting Rights Act, will be subject to orchestrated voter suppression, and explain what is being done by the Election Protection Coalition to protect voters' rights when they are confronted by voter intimidation on November the 8th. Then we are joined in the studio by Dia Schlossberg, who is a climate journalist, filmmaker, and the producer of Josh Fox's new climate change documentary, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change, the third film in an Oscar-nominated, Emmy-winning Gasland series. Dia was arrested for simply filming environmental activists interfering with oil pipelines in North Dakota and is facing 25 years in prison for the crime of practicing journalism, in a case that the Committee to Protect Journalists has called on authorities in North Dakota and Washington, quote, to drop these troubling charges and stop interfering with journalists doing their job. Then finally, we will examine the proposed $85.4 billion AT&T deal to buy Time Warner, a consolidation of endangered media monopolies reeling from competition from Netflix and Amazon, who face declining revenues from advertisers as they try to figure out what changing technology's role will be in distributing the content they have. Timothy Carr, the campaign director for Free Press and SaveTheInternet.com, joins us to discuss how companies that control the pipe into your home are being eclipsed by innovators and are trying to maximize their monopoly control to continue to milk their customers and will be charging more for worse service in order to pay off the banks who enable these mega mergers. And joining us now is Kristen Clark, who's the president and executive director of the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, one of the country's most important national civil rights organizations in the pursuit of equal justice for all, that leads the National Nonpartisan Election Protection Coalition, made up of more than 100 local, state, and national partners working to defend the right to vote. Kristen formerly served as the head of the Civil Rights Bureau for New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, then spent several years at the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, working on cases defending the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act, and also testified before Congress and state legislators. She also worked at the U.S. Department of Justice in the Civil Rights Division, serving as a federal prosecutor in the criminal section of the division and working on voting rights and redistricting cases through the division's voting section. She has written numerous articles and books, including Barack Obama and African American Empowerment, The Rise of Black America's New Leadership. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kristen Clark.
Thank you for having me.
And Kristen, I've been getting a lot of mail lately because people are very concerned about some of the remarks that Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump has made, saying that the vote's going to be rigged and urging his supporters to go to the polls in, quote, certain areas, which people interpret as meaning minority districts, to make sure that the vote is not stolen. So the mail that I'm getting from concerned listeners is, you know, what protection is out there to stop this, what appears to be a form of intimidation? Because if people show up, and some of them, if they're very, the more extreme supporters of Donald Trump, could well be armed. But in general, when one goes to the poll, you don't expect to be confronted by somebody challenging your right to vote. And that apparently is likely to happen on November the 8th.
Well, I think that it's important to distinguish two things. On the one hand, you have a candidate who alleges that the election may be rigged. And we know that those statements are false. They're baseless allegations. In our country, we don't have officials conspiring to distort the outcome of elections. You don't have this problem of election officials, you know, taking ballots and tossing them into the ocean. On the other hand, what we do know is that we have seen voter suppression play out across our country over the last several years. And voter suppression is a real issue that we are contending with today. And voter suppression, distinct from these allegations that our elections are rigged, voter suppression is what we see with states that have moved to adopt photo ID laws. Voter suppression is what we've seen when officials purge legitimately registered voters from the rolls, or when officials move polling sites to locations deemed hostile by minority voters, or when officials cut early voting hours. All of that conduct that I just identified is real conduct that we are seeing across our country today. And so when officials, when national leaders want to talk about the state of our democracy today, I wish there was a focus on the real issues that we are contending with across our country. When we do that, we know that rigged elections is not one of them.
Well, but this will be the first election without the protection of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And that has a lot of people concerned. The very issues that you're talking about were protected by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, were they not?
That's right. The Voting Rights Act is one of our nation's most important civil rights laws. And in 2013, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a ruling in a case called Shelby County, Alabama v. Holder that gut the Voting Rights Act and gut some of the core protections in the act that required that local and state officials get federal review of voting changes before they could be put into place. And as part of that federal review, they would look to see if the proposed voting change was one that would make voting more difficult, particularly for minority voters. When we had Section 5 in place, it literally blocked hundreds and hundreds of discriminatory voting changes across the country, most especially in the South, where discrimination remains very rampant. Since the 2013 Supreme Court ruling, we have seen officials race forward at lightning speed with efforts that are indeed making voting more difficult for minority voters. The Voting Rights Act, you know, without the heart of the Voting Rights Act in place this election cycle, we are seeing across the country, you know, barriers that voters need to overcome in order to cast a ballot successfully. The photo ID law in Texas was probably one of the biggest threats that we have seen in recent years. And, you know, many of these laws have been challenged in the courts. Fortunately, we're starting to see some victories with those cases. We had a victory in the Fifth Circuit in a case challenging Texas's photo ID law, one of the most restrictive laws of its kind in the nation. The evidence, real evidence in that case, showed that there were 600,000 people in Texas without the kind of ID that was required by that law. So those are 600,000 people who had been voting who were automatically stripped of that right to vote because they didn't have qualifying ID. So again, if we want to talk about the real problems that we face today, the conversation should be one focused on ending voter suppression and not this myth, this kind of conspiracy theory talk of rigged elections.
And again, I'm speaking with Kristen Clark, who's the President and Executive Director of the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, one of the country's most important national civil rights organizations in pursuit of equal justice for all, that leads the National Nonpartisan Election Protection Coalition, made up of more than 100 local, state and national partners working to defend the right to vote. Now, there were successful suits against efforts. The removal of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act suddenly created a floodgate of repressive restrictions and strict IDs, etc., in a number of states. But there was pushback in terms of appeals in Texas, Wisconsin, Kansas, and North Carolina. In North Carolina, the judges said that minorities were targeted with surgical precision. But I believe that in Texas, they're kind of slow walking, even though the courts have said they have to reverse themselves. I take it the Attorney General and the Governor are slow walking it. So this is an ongoing battle, is it not?
It is. I mean, the Fifth Circuit issued a very powerful ruling finding that Texas's photo ID law was discriminatory in effect. The lower court in Texas is now put in place a remedy to the photo ID law. But we're seeing local officials now taking efforts to undermine the weight of the court's rulings in these cases. In one county in Texas, a chief elections official has suggested that if somebody claims, you can now sign an affidavit essentially saying that I'm without ID. And if you do that, then there are other ways to confirm your identity and you can vote. There's one elections official who has suggested that he will forward to the local DA, the local district attorney, the names of voters who sign that affidavit if there's some information that suggests that that person at some point received government ID. It is very clear that those statements coming so closely timed to the November election are statements intended to have a chilling effect on voters. Let's move up to North Carolina. You have, as you noted, a Fourth Circuit court that found that North Carolina's law, known as the Monster Voter Suppression Law, was discriminatory in both its effect and in its intent. And as you noted, it was implemented with almost surgical precision to discriminate against African-American and other minority voters. But, the court also condemned officials for cutting back early voting hours. And after the ruling, we've now seen local election officials endeavor to cut early voting in their respective counties. So it's almost like we're playing a game of whack-a-mole. We have states that raced forward with these discriminatory laws, cases that took many years to play out that successfully challenged some of these laws, and now local officials who are kind of taking the baton and moving to discriminate and restrict the right to vote at the local level. This, again, is the real problem that we should see national leaders shining a spotlight on. Voter suppression is something that is real and tangible and that, is something that we are contending with today across our country.
So let's address, though, some of the listeners that have written in, because they're alarmed by what Donald Trump's been saying, and they're concerned that his supporters, who honestly believe that this election may be rigged and that there have been, a rallying call, in effect, for them to show up at the polls. What happens if you show up at the polls and there are people there challenging you? I mean, I take it that this is something that the group that you're leading, the National Nonpartisan Election Protection Coalition of more than 100 local, state and national partners who are there to defend the right to vote, are you mobilizing people as a counterweight to the possibility of this kind of intimidation?
We are indeed. Our election protection program has been in place for 14 years. It is nonpartisan, and we are focused on making sure that all eligible Americans are able to successfully cast a ballot. We encourage voters across the country to call us and report complaints to our hotline, 1-866-OUR-VOTE. And we are very wary of the potential for intimidating conduct to play out at polling sites on Election Day. The calls that have been made for untrained, you know, for poll watchers, people who we know will be untrained, the calls that have been made for law enforcement to go out on Election Day and, you know, look and see if there's anything afoot. These are all alarming calls and a real invitation for grave mischief on Election Day. If this kind of intimidating conduct unfolds, we want people to report it because it's not conduct that impacts one person. It is conduct that will likely impact many. In our country today, everyone has the right to cast a ballot and should be able to do so free from intimidation. We're watching closely to see how these plans take shape, but the mere fact that this call has been made to activate people across our country is indeed grave cause for concern. We've talked some about the Supreme Court ruling that gut the Voting Rights Act. Part of the fallout from the Supreme Court's ruling is the Justice Department's recent decision to terminate core components of its Federal Observer Program. The Federal Observer Program had been in place for decades and was essentially an effort in which the government would send trained individuals to polling sites where there were reports of the potential for intimidating conduct on Election Day. Their mere presence often helped to deter problems that otherwise might occur. But most importantly, their watchful eyes helped to ensure that the polls were open, particularly in the Deep South. So the other kind of game changer for November is that we won't have federal observers in place. Communities will be more vulnerable this election cycle. And so we need people to speak up if and when they see problems or intimidation or experience intimidation at the polls in November.
Well, just in closing, Kristen Clark, the way that people do that, though, on November 8th, presumably, is to call your hotline, 1-866-OUR-VOTE. And I take it you must be anticipating calls from all around the country.
We are. We, in fact, have the hotline open now. It's open Monday through Friday. We take calls live. We're providing support to people with early voting and absentee voting rules. And we are also on the lookout for calls about potential intimidation and efforts to rally up these kind of untrained poll watchers. So it is a very busy and intense time, but 866-OUR-VOTE is a resource that we encourage people in all 50 states to use. It is our goal to ensure that every eligible American is able to participate in this election cycle.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Kristen Clark.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Kristen Clark, who's the President and Executive Director of the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, one of the country's most important national civil rights organization in pursuit of equal justice for all, that leads the National Nonpartisan Election Protection Coalition, made up of more than 100 local, state, and national partners working to defend the right to vote at 1-866-OUR-VOTE. Kristen formerly served as the head of the Civil Rights Bureau for the New York State Attorney. Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, then spent several years at the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund working on cases defending the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act, and also testified before Congress and state legislatures. She also worked at the U.S. Department of Justice in the Civil Rights Division, serving as a federal prosecutor in the criminal section of the division and working on voting rights and redistricting cases through the division's voting section. She's written numerous articles and books, including Barack Obama and African American Empowerment, The Rise of Black America's New Leadership. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with a documentary filmmaker who was arrested for simply filming environmental activists interfering with oil pipelines in North Dakota, and who is facing 25 years in prison for the crime of practicing journalism. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dia Schlossberg, who is a climate journalist, filmmaker, and the producer of Josh Fox's new climate change documentary, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change, which is the third film in the Oscar-nominated Emmy-winning Gasland series. An award-winning filmmaker in her own right, her films on climate change and fracking can be accessed at her website, paleblue.media.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dia Schlossberg.
Thank you.
And Dia, you along with Lindsay Goodwin Grazel, as well as the cameraman Carl Davis, were arrested with a group of activists from Climate Direct Action on October the 11th in North Dakota, where you were filming these activists. I don't know whether, did they break into this place, but they turned the valve off, which then shuts down the pipeline from the tar sands of Canada through North Dakota into the United States, and you were arrested along with the activists, and you're basically facing a maximum prison sentence of 25 years on conspiracy charges for actually you're being charged with working as a journalist, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, the crime of committing journalism. But this is a serious business, right? You're not out of the woods.
No, not at all. I am out on bail right now. Yeah, facing three conspiracy charges, which are felonies.
So unlike Amy Goodman, who the judge realized it was a ridiculous charge, you're not so lucky.
Not yet. Hopefully it'll play out similarly as, yeah, exactly, I was just doing my job. Mm. But right now it's a scary place to be.
So just walk us through what happened then. Just start with, you know, one of the things they're charging with is you're actually in the same vehicle as the activists and you drove to the site with them. And that's, I guess, the prosecutors are trying to say, paint that as some form of collusion. So let's start from the morning you woke up, what you have for breakfast, whatever. You know, where do you sure. think it's a good point to tell your story? Because I'd like to hear it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was driving in the same car as the activists, as I frequently do when I'm reporting. I was interviewing them from the backseat, getting their story. I think in every documentary or short film I've made, there's some interview that happens in the car because things come out when you're driving places.
Sure. And they were driving to where?
To a site on the Keystone Pipeline. Mm-hmm. They were driving to the location of an emergency shutoff valve. And actually the action was going on in four states, five pipeline emergency valve sites. At the same time, all five pipelines were transporting oil sands from Canada into the U.S. So five humans actually shut off all of the oil sands coming into the U.S. And as a climate reporter, having worked in the field of education related to climate change for the past 13 years, and as a filmmaker for the last 8 of those years, I felt like that was a really important story to tell.
Well, it's been a long saga, the pipeline itself. It's been a huge political issue. I know I've spoken with Bill McGibbon when he protested at the White House many years ago to first bring the issue to light. It's gone back and forth with the State Department, with the various presidential candidates and President Obama himself. There's no question that this is a major news story.
Yeah, I thought so, and it definitely still is a story. And I thought that by being there, I would be reporting on the story and being able to tell the story of the pipelines and the oil sands and the people putting their lives on the line, not literally their lives because they were emergency shutoff valves and they researched the dangers and made sure it was safe. But as far as spending decades in prison, they were ready to face that because it is a climate emergency.
Right. But you weren't ready. You didn't go there thinking that you'd spend 20 years in jail.
No, not at all. I went there doing my job as I do every other day. I was filming, I was recording, I was getting interviews. I was on public property. I never trespassed. I didn't help organize the action. I was simply there documenting it.
So describe that you're on public property, you're filming them, and the emergency shutoff valve, is that surrounded by some kind of chain link fence or is there a gate or something? How did they get in? You didn't break in. You were filming from afar, right?
Yeah, and it was actually just one activist that broke into the enclosure, cut a lock, got into the chain link enclosure, and turned the shutoff valve after contacting the company and giving them ample warning that he was going to do this so that they could take any emergency precautions.
Right. So describe that further. I mean, when did he make the call? When he did it or before?
Before,
but they didn't give them time to come. What happened? How did you get arrested? Because obviously the law enforcement showed up, right?
Yeah. He wasn't trying to hide this at all. He was actually trying to live stream it. But yeah, called the company about 15 minutes ahead of time to tell them that he was on the site. And
you filmed this, I take it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So then what happens? And he turns off the valve, and then you guys didn't want to escape or anything. You waited around for the law enforcement to show up?
Yeah, yeah. He was never trying to avoid arrest.
Right.
He knew he was breaking the law as it's written, and acting in accordance of what he believes is a higher moral law to, you know, save
he's thinking about saving the planet.
Exactly.
So, and you're filming all this. So then they come and arrest you, right?
Yeah.
And who were they? Who arrested you?
It was the local police
In North Dakota.
Yeah, the local sheriff, local police.
Uh-huh.
I was pretty shocked. They said I was an accessory to a crime. I explained that I was a filmmaker doing my job, and I had not broken any laws, and I was on public property, and they still arrested me as an accessory.
And you were, 53 hours?
I was in the county jail for 53 hours, awaiting counts, awaiting some understanding of what was going on. And, yeah, they eventually brought 3 charges of conspiracy against me.
So the Committee to Protect Journalists have stepped in because this is clearly a big issue for reporting. We had a kind of preview of it with Amy Goodman. And as I say, we all know that the judge threw that charge out. But you're not so lucky. And fortunately, the Committee to Protect Journalists have stepped in to try and help you. So tell us what the next step is here in terms of you're facing, what, is it 20 years in jail you're facing?
25. The charges, total 45 years, but a couple of the charges are alternate, meaning it's one or the other.
I see.
Each of those carries 20 years.
Right.
Which, I mean, they're both such huge abstract numbers when you're talking about years of your life ahead of you in prison. So the difference is kind of irrelevant. But yeah, the next steps, I don't know exactly. I'm very thankful for all the support from all sorts of media and organizations that are stepping up to speak out on behalf of me and Lindsay and Carl, who were the filmmakers in Washington State where this action was also happening, and they're also facing felony charges.
Well, it is, you know, pretty clear that the oil sands that are coming down from Canada have been incredibly controversial. They are still coming. They come by rail car, which is in itself pretty dangerous, and there have been a number of accidents. The chief climate scientist at NASA, is now at Columbia, said that the Keystone Pipeline is game over for the environment, because based upon how much carbon is in that stuff, because it's very dirty, and that we have to simply stop and get off fossil fuels as soon as possible, because the evidence of climate change is manifest, even though there are these deniers out there. So in a way, it would seem to me that the survival of the species and the survival of the planet rest upon us all becoming, we're sort of in the same lifeboat, are we not? And it's really a question of a form of global patriotism, not nationalism, not national laws, but the global kind of law of survival and protecting the planet, which is being on the verge of being irreversibly damaged. So that, you know, to my mind, is a higher law. Now, I guess what they're arguing is that this is a part of national vital infrastructure. Is that what they're saying? If we're at war and say the Germans in World War II came in and turned off a similar valve to shut down vital oil pipeline or something, that would be sabotage, and they'd be hung as they were during World War II. So walk us through the arguments, your argument versus their argument.
Well,
not that you're particularly sympathetic to their argument.
They're saying that the pipeline is critical infrastructure and a public utility. And the reality is that the Keystone Pipeline and several of these other oil sands pipelines are transporting private oil, private Dilbit and Syncrude. And right. It's on its way to a refinery where it will be processed and then put on the global market.
It's not a public service so much as private enterprise, right?
Right.
They say it's a public service to provide us with energy, but they get compensated for it, right?
Yeah, this is their income. They say it's public because, well, in this case, TransCanada makes the pipeline available for other companies to use, but it's all right. Oil sands that they are profiting from.
Right. So is Homeland Security involved in this?
I'm not sure. Really? Not that I know of. Our charges are all state.
All state?
Yeah.
So the local sheriffs arrest you, but then the state of North Dakota. That's the same state prosecutors that prosecuted Amy Goodman for rioting, right?
It's actually a different state attorney.
It is?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. But it's the same office,
I presume.
Yeah, yeah. So when are you in court?
I call in on November 7th to schedule the preliminary hearing.
Uh-huh.
And at that hearing, they'll give me some more information and say whether the state has enough evidence to prosecute.
Uh-huh.
So we'll see.
So who's defending you? I mean, you've got the Committee to Protect Journalists advocating on your behalf, but who's actually defending you?
Ron Kuby is my lawyer.
And does he have experience in these matters?
Oh, yeah. He's one of the best.
Is he? And who's he with? I mean, I don't need to know the law firm, but is there a subset of the law in terms of environmental activism?
He's a civil rights lawyer.
Right.
Who's been.
So this will be a First Amendment case then, right? Long and the short of it?
Yep.
You're a reporter, documentarian, mm-hmm. and you were doing your job.
Yeah.
And you have First Amendment protection.
Yes.
Which is why I think the judge threw the case out against Amy Goodman, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So are you I guess the good news is that even the Supreme Court, as conservative as it is pretty strong on the First Amendment.
It's hard to argue with the First Amendment.
Uh-huh. But they'll try.
They'll certainly try.
They already have, right? I mean,
yeah.
You wouldn't be talking to me now.
Exactly.
So what's it feel like to be thinking about 25 years of bologna sandwiches?
it's terrifying. Not the bologna sandwiches, but the... I think our most precious non-renewable resource is time. And what we choose to do with that time, that limited time in our lives, and certainly with all the time I've had so far in my life, I've tried to do what I can for the greater good, and the thought of not being able to do that for the next couple of decades is absolutely devastating.
And how long have you been on this earth?
36 years.
36 years. So that's, you'd be, what, about 60, right?
Yeah.
61.
Mm-hmm.
That is a horrifying thought, isn't it?
It sure is.
So tell me about Edward Snowden coming to your defense.
That was kind of surreal. Yeah, he tweeted a link to my story and a picture and said that he said this journalist is facing 45 years. And just for reference, my maximum sentence is 30 years.
Oh. Oh, that's
so that gives a little perspective.
Right. Although he's beyond the reach of the law. You have to show up in North Dakota on November the 7th, right?
No, I have to call in on November 7th to figure out when I need to show up in North Dakota for the preliminary hearing.
I see. But that's something you have to do, right?
Yeah.
You're out on bail.
Right.
Otherwise you'd be a fugitive, right?
Mm-hmm.
So is this going to be expensive for you?
I'm getting help. There's a lot of people working pro bono. ACLU has said they would help. There's a lot of people that are contributing to. There's a legal defense fund that's set up,
right,
that people are contributing to. And
give us the details. Maybe some of our listeners want to help you out.
Sure. It's actually for all of the journalists that were arrested. It's through the site of the action, which is shutitdown.today, and there's a link to donate there.
Shutitdown.today. So there's a rally, a climate rally today, Sunday, in MacArthur Park here in Los Angeles with Shailene Woodley, of course, who was also arrested along with Amy Goodman. Tell us about that. Ed Begley Jr., who's a big supporter of this radio station,
mm-hmm,
is going to be there along with Francis Fisher, and you're going to be there, right? So tell our audience quickly about this event.
Sure. We've been doing a series of climate rallies around the country, kind of to follow up in the momentum of the Bernie campaign and empowering people to keep this revolution going, and particularly to focus on climate, which was not mentioned in a single debate question for the presidential race.
In all three debates, must say. It was pretty amazing.
Pretty absurd. But
so this is at 4:30, right?
Yeah, it's at MacArthur Park.
4:30, Ozzy Motley will be performing. Show up and meet Adia, and Josh will be there, right?
Josh will be there. We'll be screening the film. Screening the film. And we encourage people to bring blankets and pillows to sit on to watch the film. And then if you can donate those, they'll be going to local homeless shelters afterwards.
Well, Adia Schlossberg, I thank you so much for joining us here today in the studio.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Adia Schlossberg, who's a climate journalist, filmmaker, and producer of Joss Fox's new climate change documentary, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change, which is the third film in the Oscar-nominated, Emmy-winning Gasland series. An award-winning filmmaker in her own right, her films on climate change and fracking can be accessed on her website, paleblue.media.com. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the proposed $85.4 billion AT&T deal to buy Time Warner. ¶¶ Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Timothy Carr, who's the Campaign Director for Free Press and the SaveTheInternet.com Coalition. He also writes for the Huffington Post and on his personal blog, MediaCitizen.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Timothy Carr.
Hi, Ian. How are you?
Very well, thanks. And in the wake of Comcast's $30 billion takeover of NBC Universal and Verizon Communications acquisition of the Huffington Post and Yahoo, now we have a really big merger, an $85.4 billion merger between Time Warner, the home of NBC, of CNN and HBO, and Warner Brothers Movies, etc., with AT&T. So on the surface, you know, and you've also got other mergers like Lionsgate buying Stars, etc. So clearly, all of these monopolies are becoming even greater monopolies. But this one seems to be, I think, is this an historic high, $85.4 billion?
It's big. And, you know, this is kind of a new type of merger that we're seeing of late. And it's there have been horizontal mergers where you see companies that do similar things, like Charter, which is a cable company, and Time Warner Cable, which is the cable version of Time Warner. It was spun off from Time Warner about 7 years ago. With those merged, which in a way that's called horizontal, where you have companies that do similar things joining forces to control more of that marketplace. What we're seeing here and with the other mergers that you mentioned is a type of vertical integration where you have a company like AT&T, which is a wireless phone and internet provider that is purchasing a company that's in another realm of the media that produces content. And when you have things like that, obviously it raises concerns about, you know, will this internet service then start to bias itself in favor of the content that is provided by Time Warner properties? And those properties include channels like HBO, news stations like CNN, and things like that. So there's what's called a net neutrality concern there. But there are also concerns on the consumer end, is whether this control over content and distribution to almost monopoly levels will end up costing consumers more. So there's a lot more that needs to be done before we can say this is a deal worth approving. I mean, Free Press, my organization, has already said, with good reason, that regulators should reject it.
So, but I understand that these big companies are being eclipsed by these online outlets like Netflix and Amazon and YouTube, etc., and they're attracting a younger demographic. And frankly, since I started to watch things on YouTube, on Amazon and Netflix, it's hard to go back to network television because it's the content is garbage by and large, and it's just much more user-friendly to be able to, you know, these new outlets. So are they really trying to play catch-up here? And at the end of the day, are they doomed? Is there this massive demographic and generational switch underway? You know, the younger generation today, everything is on demand for them. They don't, you know, tune in at a certain time to watch a certain show on television.
Well, I mean, you know, in an environment where other types of similar types of mergers are happening, you'll see these companies, you know, just trying to keep up with their competitors to try to merge in similar ways that they're seeing Verizon merge and similar ways that they've seen Comcast merge. But there really isn't any long-term strategy here. I don't think they really know what this means over the long term, how it will benefit customers over the long term, because they don't really care. What they're really interested in, the sort of short-term returns that they get in the stock market when these types of mergers are announced. There are also very sizable rewards for the executives at these companies to once they complete these mergers. It's created a boon among lobbyists in Washington, D.C., who are hired by these companies to lobby the various forces in play, the Federal Communications Commission, the Federal Trade Commission, the Department of Justice, to approve these mergers. So it creates a lot of short-term cash for these executives and the influence economy that runs Washington, D.C., but there are no long-term benefits that we can see for consumers out there.
Well, Tim, that sort of gets to the point that I've felt for some time now, particularly with AT&T. I used to have AT&T, and it didn't even work. The cell phone connections at my home in West Los Angeles didn't work. I lost, calls would drop out all the time. And I finally had to switch to Verizon. And the reason that happened was that AT&T were just simply not investing in infrastructure. They were great at billing you, but they were no good at serving you. And they seemed to spend all their money on advertising, telling you how great they are, and also on lobbying in Washington, which is you just referred to. So forgive me for being skeptical, but I don't think that AT&T, since it hasn't really caught up and doesn't even have the kind of service that Verizon had, that they're going to be spending money on infrastructure and improving customer service. They're obviously, as you say, basically looking to Wall Street and to the stock price.
Yes, I mean that's the motivating force. And one other thing, that when these sorts of deals are created, they take on a considerable debt in order to complete the deal to make the purchase. As you mentioned earlier, this is estimated to be somewhere in the neighborhood of $85 billion. A part of that structure involves taking on debt, and the only way that they service that debt is through charging higher prices to customers. So we would much rather they took whatever money they're willing to spend on this, whether debt they're willing to take on, to improve their networks, to reach more people with fast, affordable broadband services, to serve the customers that they've already captured with better services as well, and then trying to complete these sorts of deals, which really have very little public interest benefit. So, I mean, we'd rather they do what they do better than get into new businesses and to squander any sort of innovation that might be potentially available there.
But surely, though, as a consumer, you have so little choice in your cable provider, which usually provides you with both internet service as well as cable. And again, just to speak from personal experience, we had Time Warner, and then they had a fight with CBS, just these two corporate, toe-to-toe, penis-measuring competition between these executives, and we were the collateral damage, the customers. They didn't give a damn about us. They just wanted to out-macho each other. So we switched to satellite, DirecTV, which then was bought by AT&T, I think. It wasn't bought by AT&T. What happened is suddenly they changed to a company called Frontier, that nobody's ever heard of, and they have even worse service. So we're thinking of then, well, God, we better get back to Time Warner, even though we hate them. And now they're being bought by AT&T. So you have less and less choice as a consumer.
Yes. This is a new wave of consolidation. I think what one of the things that we're looking for as this deal has been announced is, what the political climate is like for allowing this sort of continued consolidation. And because we've had a history of industry consolidation in the communications sector that goes back 30 years, goes back really to the last antitrust action of note, which was the breakup of AT&T in the mid-1980s. And we've reached a point where we're seeing the old Ma Bell consolidate into these powerful cable television and movie production and internet access conglomerates like Comcast, like what AT&T is trying to accomplish. And the question then for Washington is not, you know, are you going to approve this deal? It's like, when do antitrust concerns kick in again? Have we reached a point where this is getting so out of hand that customers are suffering from these types of monopolies that we need to look at antitrust regulation more seriously? Now, Secretary Clinton did write something in 2015 about her concerns about consolidation, not just in, you know, cable sector, but in the healthcare sector and other areas, and that we do need to take these sorts of antitrust concerns more seriously. And even the Republican nominee, Donald Trump, just yesterday said that he was not in favor of this merger. He cited different concerns. He said a long-term beef with media, in particular CNN, which is one of the properties that will be a part of this deal. So he's even said that he'd be willing to oppose this deal were he elected president.
Right, but not for policy reasons, but for personal grudges.
Which seems to be the case with Kennedy,
yeah. Yeah, with his M.O. So whatever happened to Apple? I thought Apple were in talks with
all of these talks, these negotiations happen behind closed doors. Occasionally somebody will leak something to the press, which was the case in advance of AT&T's announcement. There were reports in the Wall Street Journal from unnamed sources as well as the New York Times. We haven't heard really of the details of the Apple negotiation there, but clearly, you know, some of the new tech companies like Apple, like Google, and even Facebook are looking at the landscape, and they're seeing this consolidation by the more traditional outlets and thinking that they need to play a part in this game as well.
But they are much more imaginative, those companies, you know, particularly when you think about Netflix and Amazon. They're so much more user-friendly. That's why once you use them, you don't really want to go back to the network television.
They're not burdened by the legacy. You have, like, right. With cable television, there is a massive legacy of trying to control the pipe, trying to control how people view video. Trying to prevent people from viewing video via the internet, for example. There's a set-top box proceeding at the FCC right now in which the cable companies are trying to keep that cable box that everybody has, every cable subscriber has, as the gatekeeper to all video. And we now live in a time, and this is something that Amazon and Google and Netflix understand very well, we now live at a time where we should be able to watch whatever we want via our high-speed internet connection. And the problem and the fear that companies like AT&T and Comcast and Time Warner Cable is that they're going to lose their gatekeeper status, and that we're just going to boot up our computers and our high-speed connection and watch whatever we want via an internet screen. That's the direction that technology is taking us, and that seems like a natural evolution in the media. But when you have these very large conglomerates, sometimes innovation and, you know, the natural evolution of things runs against their best interests.
But that's what other people in the rest of the world have in South Korea and Japan. They have gigabyte speed, a high-speed internet. You know, where I think the national average in America is 9 megabytes compared to 1,000. There's a couple of outliers. Chattanooga, Tennessee has a local utility that offers a gigabyte, and I think somewhere else as well in the country. Google are laying down fiber optics as well to provide that service. What's happening in that horizon? Because if you could get a gigabyte high-speed broadband, then you don't need all this other stuff. These people have become automatically dinosaurs overnight, aren't they? That AT&T's and companies, etc.
Well, I think you've put your finger on the problem here. And if you look at countries like South Korea and parts of in the Netherlands and Japan, they have high-speed services that allows people to use their internet connection to accomplish any number of things, including, you know, watching television. And there have been several studies comparing the policy structures in those countries to the policy structure in the United States. And one thing that stands out is this idea of open access, which is really the idea that once that high-speed, that gigabit pipe, is whether it's fiber or coaxial cable, comes into your home, then you can use it for any number of things. That there are a lot of services that can ride on that cable that would provide you, or that fiber optic connection that would provide you with television, et cetera. And so they have an open access policy regime that we don't quite have here in the United States. Now, we did accomplish a good step in that direction when the FCC in 2015 passed net neutrality protections. Net neutrality prevents our internet access provider from discriminating about the types of content that comes over our pipe, but they still have a hold on the way cable television gets in. And so there's this battle between the internet companies that have all of these end services, companies like Netflix that want to stream television over your internet connection, and the legacy phone and cable providers who want to limit their ability to do so. And one of the things that they're doing of late is putting data caps on your internet connection. Comcast has a data cap. Time Warner Cable has been experimenting with data caps as well that would prevent people from watching too much via their internet connection or listening to too much music. Because if you reach a certain limit in data, they can then start charging you exorbitant rates that makes using your internet connection in that way no longer affordable.
These people are essentially standing in the way of progress.
These people are essentially standing in the way of progress. They're very powerful companies that have a great deal of influence in Washington, D.C. They have a great deal of influence over the marketplace. They can put innovators out of business by not letting them use their internet service in order to distribute whatever it is, the service they're providing. They're very powerful companies, and they're getting bigger, and that's where antitrust concerns come into play. And again, the question is, you know, at what point do we return to the sort of regulatory approach we took in the 80s when we broke up AT&T?
Well, at the end of the day, it looks as though these companies are just relying on their political clout, their lobbying power, to stay alive, and the last thing that they care about is serving the public, and they're just there to milk the public and take everything they can as long as they can, while there are other companies like Amazon and Netflix and Apple, etc., that are dealing with the future. And, you know, they are very much user-friendly company, Apple, compared to these others. You know, I really see this as a battle between the innovators and the parasites.
Yeah, well, I mean, true, but at some point, we also need to look at companies like Apple, like Amazon and Facebook, which are becoming, reaching monopoly stature in their own right. So it's sort of like, you know, the new revolutionary becomes the old boss. And so, you know, as they gain more control, as Google gains control over search, for example, and Apple control over the way people stream music and the devices that they use to do that, we should be looking at these companies as well with a somewhat suspicious eye and be concerned about the monopoly types of abuses that often happen when a company has that much control.
Well, I stand corrected, and you've made a very a good argument there, Timothy Carr. And I thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Timothy Carr, who's the campaign director for Free Press and the SaveTheInternet.com Coalition. He also writes for the Huffington Post and on his personal blog, MediaCitizen.com. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.